Hi, the Kodesh Chaim asked that after Moshe Rabbeinu came to Paro after the Makas Choshech, a plague of darkness, Paro still tried to negotiate with Moshe about who all was going to leave. Okay, so the adults will go with the children, we can leave the cattle here, and Moshe said to him, no way, everybody's going. So Paro finally lost it with Moshe, and he said, Lech mi olay, get out of here. I'm warning you, don't look at my face again, because on the day you see my face, you're going to die. And Moshe says to him, you have spoken well, I will not see your face anymore. And that's when he gives him the last warning about the plague of the firstborn. And when he completes that warning, Moshe leaves Paro angrily. The question is, why is Moshe angry? And Rashi says he's angry because Paro said to him, don't look at my face anymore. Why was Moshe angry when he left Paro? Paro should have been angry. I mean, Paro was the one who was angry with Moshe. Moshe had been whistling when he left, or equivalent. King Fred's question was, and this week's Seder we have the juxtaposition of the Exodus, the mitzvah of tefillin, and the mitzvah relating to the firstborn, the redemption of the firstborn. I think one of the more difficult things that we navigate, or maybe fail to navigate, is the very thin membrane between what we think in our heads and what we actually do in the following way. We have a set of values and a set of priorities that we respect in our heads. And because we have these values and these priorities and these ideals that we are committed to and that we respect and that are very precious to us, that becomes sort of a quasi-reality for us. And we think that we live in that reality, even though in our lives those same priorities are not necessarily reflected every day in what we live. So it's not that we're corrupt or dishonest, but any one of us would say that we think that serving God is the most important thing, and we would say that Avodas Hashem in davening or in learning or trying to enrich the lives of others, that those are the most important things. But our lives are really dominated by a whole lot of pedestrian things, like gas in the car and eating breakfast and fixing the stuffed sink in the bathroom, and a thousand other things that consume so much of our lives. And we are going to get to the other things eventually. Not clear when that eventually is. And even if we do get to them, we get to them in fairly modest kinds of quantities of time. And then only when we've gotten the other stuff out of the way. If somebody were to confront us with the actuality of our lives and say to us, this is who you are, this is what you are, we would say to them, not true. I am what I think I am. I am the things that I revere. I am the priorities that I think of in my head. But the things that we think in our head, if they're not living priorities in our lives and are somehow demonstrable in the quantity of our time and the quality of our time that we devote to them. There are people who do learn every day, for example, but they learn every day at a time when they're so exhausted that the quality of their learning isn't very good. I mean, they do everything else early on in the day when they got to get them done, and then finally, oh, now I can sit down and learn. Now I don't have anything on my head. When they don't have anything on their head anymore, they also don't have any head. and act, we give priority to the things that don't mean as much to us as the others. It's just kind of the way. In a certain sense, the real key, the real secret to living a sacred life is not only to think prayer. It's very important to be able, because one of the big problems, in a certain sense a bigger problem than the one I just mentioned, is people who don't have any sense at all of their priorities. They're just constantly living reflexively. They're just constantly responding. They just react. Their lives just react. They don't even have a sense. If you were to say to them, well, what's more important? I don't know. I haven't thought about it. So you need a sense of what's sacred and how they relate to each other in priority. And then we need to actually live those priorities. It's not inconceivable that one might configure a Mitzrayim. I mean, it happens to me that Mitzrayim was a nasty place. It was a dehumanizing situation of bondage and servitude. But it need not have been that extent of either brutality or servitude to have qualified to be Mitzrayim. All it needed to be was a place, perhaps very much like our own world, our own culture, where we are so engaged, we are so driven by other things that the real important things in our lives don't get worked on. So in a certain sense, we become slaves to all of the very ordinary and pedestrian demands of life. The things that Eitan over here was just calling the way in which the physical world imposes itself on us. But if we end up spending the better part of our lives responding to the demands of the impositions of that physical world, the bottom line is that we're serving a different master. In that sense, we're still slaves. So if we could think of the sink symbolically rather than thinking of it as a detail, specific, one might say we have too many sinks. We don't live simple lives. And because we don't leave simple lines, we're just occupied with so many more things. And our computer goes down, it occupies a half a day for us to fix it. And if something goes wrong with our car, so it's, you know, we just live very complex lives. We don't live simple lives. The key, then, to freeing ourselves from servitude, in whatever measure we can free ourselves, is to live our priorities, is to understand what comes first, and to put what comes first, and to live and act what comes first. There's a balance over here. We have to strike a balance. The balance is someplace between finding, even in the marketplace, it means somehow acquiring as modest amount of the marketplace as you possibly can. The question over here is finding the balance between how much you're buying in deprives you of. Sometimes first or prioritization can be reflected in issues of quantity, such as I spend this much time on my good deeds, my introspection, my Torah, my davening, my mitzvahs, whatever, and I spend so much time on the rest of things. Sometimes it's reflected not so much in time as in quality, such as I devote my times of greatest clarity to doing things, and I don't give my best to the world. I give my best to the Kodesh. The issue is, in a certain sense, what our Sedra is trying to tell us is that the key to living a holy spiritual existence is putting first. The firstborn is holy. And generally there's a principle in Ma'avirin Ala Mitzvahs that if you have a mitzvah which is before you, you have to do the mitzvah that's in front of you rather than pass over the mitzvah to do something else, even though they may both be there. But when it's closer to you, you don't pass over the mitzvah that's closer to you from mitzvah, which is more distant. So, let's say you have your bag of tilling, and because you're distracted, instead of pulling out your shell yad, you pull out your shell rosh. Now, the principle of in mavirin ala mitzvahs would suggest that you have to put on your shell rosh first, because it's there. You're already holding it. Don't set it aside, embarrassing the mitzvah. But the Torah tells you that there is a priority over here. You have to put on your shell yad before your shell rosh. So you set it aside, you violate the principle of in mavirin ala mitzvahs in deference to this priority which the Torah gives. Now, the Sfarim say that the reason that the Torah insists that whenever you're wearing your shel rosh, you have to already be wearing your shel yad. You can't put on your shel rosh without your shel yad, and God, unless God forbid a person is an amputee chalila. Otherwise, he must always be wearing his shel yad. It's because the shel rosh represents the intellect, and the shel yad represents action. And if you have intellect without action, you have zip. But if you have action, then at least you've done something in the world, even if your mind and intellect are not engaged. It's missing a tremendous amount, but you've got something. You've engaged the physical world. The point over here, once again, is that the key is what comes first. Tefillin tells you that what comes first is recognizing that you're living in a world of doing. The world of intellect that you live in, where you say to yourself, but I think of holy things, and in my mind I revere things that are holy much more than the things that are, that when I'm changing the oil in my car, that doesn't mean anything to me. What does mean something to me is when I have times that I can practice Torah and mitzvahs. That really means so much more to me. So we content ourselves or comfort ourselves or console ourselves, as the case may be, with the fact that in our minds these things are more holy, but we don't live there. So the mitzvah of tefillin is really a mitzvah that speaks to the fact that we don't live in our heads. We live in a world of action, and that world of action has to reflect what we're thinking. And if it doesn't reflect what we're thinking, then we've got our Rosh on without our Shel Yad. Anyway, to extend that one step further, the Sfarim talk about a very interesting dynamic, which is that there is something which happens. Let's say a person sees a situation which is an invitation, a blandishment to doing something which is a violation of Hashem's will. And recognizing that this is something which is not appropriate for him, he picks himself up out of that situation and runs away. So what you have over here is, it would seem that all you have is a rejection of evil. As far as I'm saying, I think it's Isaiah, the Shem Yishmol brings it. I don't know if it's Isaiah, or he brings it in the name of his grandfather of Kotzko, but he establishes the principle that a rejection of evil is not just like you stayed in the same place, but you rejected the evil. No, you didn't let the evil get to you. But to the extent that a person flees from evil, to that very same extent has he entered Kedusha. It's not just a negation, it is an acquisition. It's an acquisition of as much positive as there was energy expended in the rejection of the negative. So it's not just the absence of evil, it's really an acquisition of positive. But that only works if good has rejected evil, not if evil has rejected good. In other words, evil may say to itself, I have no business here. I have nothing to do here. This is a waste of my time. This person is not a candidate for my... So I'm going elsewhere. So it depends what comes first. If good comes first and rejects evil, there's been an acquisition. If evil comes first by rejecting good, so person is out of the woods, but he has not made that acquisition of good. And I think that what troubled Moshe in the broadest possible sense is that it was Pharaoh who rejected him when he really should have rejected Pharaoh. It came to a time when he should have said to Pharaoh, my work is over. I'm not visiting you anymore. I have nothing at all to do with you. I don't want to look at your face anymore. You're an evil person. But Pharaoh beat him to the punch, and Moshe recognized that that was a loss of an opportunity.